Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. We once again just heard an interview with Lucy Lutt. For more information about how to get her album, or to find out about her next album, or her tour info, or any of that, you can visit her website. The address is www.luciidlout.com. Or you can visit the website of her label, Arbor Records, and that address is www.arborrecords.com. Thanks a lot, Lucy, for taking the chance to speak with us. So now we're just going to read some news. We've got one, appropriately enough, about the melting of Inuit land, as reported in the Canadian press. An extensive international study on the effects of climate change in the Arctic has reached some startling conclusions on issues ranging from how fast polar ice is melting to the impact on Inuit communities. About 120 scientists from 11 countries involved in the Canadian-led research project, which started in 2002, are meeting in Winnipeg to present and discuss their findings. One of the most surprising was the fact that polar ice is melting at a rate of about 74,000 square kilometers a year, an area about the size of Lake Superior, and has been for the last 30 years, says Dr. Barber, a sea ice specialist at the University of Manitoba. This is a very significant result and is not some sort of trend that's going to shift back the other way. Dr. Barber added there's increasing concern in the scientific community that there are factors actually speeding up the melt, but he cautions that it's too late to reverse the trend. The time to act actually was a few decades ago, he said. We're not going to be able to shift the economies of the planet to get off this fossil fuel addiction in a week, a year, or a decade. But we have to start the process now to have some stability for future generations. Louis Fortier, a researcher with Université Laval in Quebec City, who led the project, agreed the focus in Canada and internationally needs to be on coping with the reality of global warming and minimizing the damage. If we wanted to really change things to avoid the bulk of the impacts of climate change, we would have to totally change our way of life tomorrow. Further research will be done in the coming years to look at the socioeconomic, cultural, and geopolitical impact of political change. But the Inuit, who spend much of the year living off the sea and ice, are already feeling the negative effects. The ice is not as safe for travel, houses are being washed away as shorelines erode by as much as 6 meters a year, and food sources such as caribou and seals could eventually disappear and be replaced by other species from other areas within the next century. They are hoping that the Kyoto Protocol will be able to fix things a bit or stem the flow somewhat. But whatever. Here's hoping. Meanwhile, the land is melting and people are being left homeless. The next piece is a call out from the Black Mesa Indigenous Support to ask for support in the stopping of relocation of people from the big mountain of Black Mesa in Arizona. So it reads, something critical is about to happen concerning the traditional communities on Big Mountain and surrounding areas on Black Mesa. Today, more than 30 years after the passage of Public Law 93531, the original Navajo Hopi Relocation Bill, a new bill is before Congress that sets a new timetable for the forced relocation of a number of Navajo families on Black Mesa. Senate Bill S-1003, the Navajo Hopi Land Settlement Act Amendments of 2005, is now on the Senate calendar and may be passed at any time without debate or serious consideration unless the public acts now. The last major relocation bill was approved by the Senate within a month after being placed on the Senate calendar and stayed in the House of Representatives less than a week before becoming law. It's difficult to convey the serious nature of these new developments. The passage of this bill would effectively devastate these traditional communities of Navajo or Diné, stripping them of their identity and way of life, which is tied into the land itself. Navajo people's lives and livelihoods are on the line. This bill will permanently displace the indigenous families of Big Mountain and surrounding communities on Black Mesa from their ancestral lands and will relieve the federal government of any further responsibility for the relocated peoples. S-1003, sponsored by Senator McCain, comes as Peabody Coal, the world's largest coal company, is planning to expand its strip mining of American Indian lands, drawing down a high-quality residential aquifer in the process. Only one thing stands in Peabody's way. Indigenous people live on the land below which lies billions of tons of low-sulfur coal. As with their ancestors, the land is the basis for the Black Mesa people's traditions, spiritualities, and livelihoods. But there is still time to act. S-1003 may pass the Senate and the House of Representatives within the next week or weeks. Senate Bill 1003 may become law any time now, once again starting the machine of forced relocation. But fortunately, a small window of opportunity exists to stop it. It must first pass the Senate, so the Senate Indian Affairs Committee and individual senators must hear from your voices today. The indigenous families from the Big Mountain and Black Mesa communities have not been represented in this process. It is up to us, the public, and the international community to demand that Congress educate themselves before they vote. After passing the earlier Relocation Act in 1974, several senators expressed misgivings about the law, but by that time, of course, it was too late. We cannot allow this to happen again. The people of Big Mountain are asking us to jump in and shake up the political landscape. Our outcry may be their only hope. We must tell those who would once again sell out the people and the land that there will be a political price to pay. It's easy to make decisions from afar if you never risk meeting the people who will be affected. Demand that Congress listen to the people. Maybe it is possible to reach their hearts. Thank you and peace, Black Mesa Indigenous Support. So for more information, you can visit the website www.democracyinaction.org. And it is crucial, if you're listening to this in the States, do write to your senator or your representative. If you are living elsewhere, you can still contact these officials or visit U.S. Consulates or embassies in your city. Let them know that there is international support for the Black Mesa communities, and that we won't stand for any more forced relocation of indigenous peoples off of their land. So we're going to take a short musical break, but then we will be right back with more Native Solidarity News.
Daylight is breaking, the sun touches fire. I Got to make another powwow tonight. I'll be singing 49 down by the riverside, looking for sugar, riding in my Indian car. The radiator steams. One headlight don't work, the radio can scream. I got a sticker that says Indian Power. I stuck it on a bumper, that's what holds my car together. We're on the circuit of an Indian dream. We don't get old, we just get younger. When we're flying down the highway, riding in our Indian car. On the circuit of an Indian dream. We don't get old, we just get younger. When we're flying down the highway, riding in our Indian cars. Riding in our Indian cars. Riding in our Indian cars. Go ahead.
Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. In the background, we're listening to Buffy St. Marie with their song, Darling Don't Cry. And before that, we heard Keith Cicola with his song, Indian Cars. And once again, this is from the compilation put out by Canadian Council for the Arts called Soundtrack of a People. So we're coming back with an announcement from the organization Justice for Girls. They sent out an announcement about youth prisoners being shackled in the middle of a sweat lodge ceremony. And this is apparently policy by the Ministry of Children and Family Development, which is responsible for youth prisons in British Columbia. The policy explicitly requires that prison staff apply one set of leg restraints to each prisoner participating in the sweat lodge ceremony. The policy was amended within the last 4 years to make it more specific to every youth who enters the sweat lodge. Urban Native Youth Association, Justice for Girls, United Native Nations, and the Knowledgeable Aboriginal Youth Association, KAYA, have collectively sent a letter to Stan Hagen, the Minister of Child and Family Development, demanding an immediate stop to shackling of youth and any use of force during the sacred sweat lodge ceremony. The use of mechanical restraints during the sweat lodge ceremony is an assault upon the bodies, dignity, spirit, and culture of Indigenous youth. The sacred sweat lodge is an important ceremony that is not only a right under Section 70 of the Child, Family, and Community Services Act, but, more importantly, an attempt to remedy some of the effects of colonization, including cultural genocide. It is imperative that this policy be changed immediately. They are encouraging people to call or write or email the Minister of Children and Family Development to demand policy change and immediate stop to the shackling of youth during the sweat lodge ceremony at Burnaby Youth Secure Custody Center. And they are inviting you to contact Justice for Girls by either calling or emailing them. The phone number is 604-689-7887. And the email is justiceforgirls, one word, at justiceforgirls.org. The phone number, once again, is 604-689-7887. And the next piece comes, the next news piece comes to us from the Times Dispatch. It's about an interesting and I think healthy bit of non-Native solidarity, because it does so often happen that that news pieces will be ignored by a larger or the issues will be ignored by a larger non-Native population, and so it's just refreshing to find out that the United Methodist General Conference has eliminated Richmond for its 2012 General Conference, which will host 1,000 delegates and 4,000 attendees, because of the name of Richmond's baseball team, the Braves. The denomination's commission on the General Conference is moving the convention to Tampa because of its policy, begun in 2004, of not meeting in cities home to professional sports teams with American Indian names. When Richmond was selected, commission members were unaware the minor league baseball team is the Richmond Braves, according to a statement released on February 16th. Gail Murphy Geis of Centennial, Colorado, the commission chairwoman, says, however well-intended, sports teams named after Native Americans demean the heritage of Native peoples. The conference estimates that the 10-day gathering would generate about $20 million in anticipated direct spending. Richmond Braves spokesman John Emmett said, we've had the name over 40 years now. Our parent team, the Atlanta Braves, has had it for 100 years. With their policy, there are not too many places they can meet. Jack Berry, president of the Richmond Metropolitan Convention and Visitors Bureau, said the conference would have been the second largest convention when factoring the numbers of visitors and nights booked in hotel rooms. Way to go, United Methodists. That is pretty rad. And I hope that other, you know, it's not a huge, they're not taking up arms, you know, or like it's easy, and it's not a big statement, but it's an easy way of making direct solidarity and saying that, no, this isn't okay. Who cares if you've had, the name for 100 years? It's racist. Deal with it. And so, yeah, that's right on. And so, you know, the next piece kind of segues into that. We can talk about the 2010 Olympics, for example, in Vancouver, where people are really pumped for some reason about the Inuktitut logo being appropriated for the Vancouver Olympics. And, you know, here again, people could just very easily say, no, it's not okay to have these Olympics on stolen land in Skekequilt. So the next piece, however, is coming from Australia, where Aboriginals are saying that, the Australian Sydney Games are not okay. It's not okay that they happen. It's just a sporting event, but it also generates money. It is also a big nationalist enterprise, and it's not okay that it happen on stolen land, and it's not okay that it purport to be somewhat of a unification between Australians, both white and black. According to the spokesman for the Indigenous rights groups, Black GST, having this myth of unification, quote, it was a joke, a dead set fair dinkum joke. The Indigenous people in Sydney were bought off. The Black DST, and this is coming from an article by The Age, the Black DST, the initials stand for Genocide, Sovereignty, and Treaty, is organizing a mass camp and a march to coincide with the opening of the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne next month. Spokesman Targan said that if Indigenous Australians were lulled into relative apathy in 2000, they would not make the same mistake in front of another international audience. Targan said millions of dollars were allocated for Indigenous people in the Sydney Games to little effect. He's quoted as saying, "The government went in there and divided and conquered them through money here and money there. There was all these jobs for a short period of time, but nothing sustainable was done." He fears the same will happen in Melbourne. In Victoria, an Indigenous task force set up by the state government in the lead-up to the Games last year released a strategy on Indigenous recognition and participation in and during the Games. As part of this strategy, a, quote, welcome place will operate every day of the Games in Federation Square, where visitors can meet Indigenous elders. Bush Tucker will be available. Aboriginal art will be hung in the Games Village, and an Aboriginal craft market will be set up on Swanston Street. The Games opening will include Indigenous motifs, and about 30 elders are expected to appear in possum skin cloaks. There have been smaller, community-based initiatives around the state. Targan dismisses such programs as tokenistic and argues that they have been designed to create the impression of involvement and support without tackling entrenched Indigenous disadvantage. He is critical of those he calls the Indigalites, Aboriginal representatives chosen to work with the government on committees such as that for the Games, and dismissive of the supposed elders who will appear in the opening ceremony. He continues, "Now these people that they are calling elders, I would say 80% of them are not elders' backsides. What they are just old Aboriginal people. An elder in our society was someone who had worked tirelessly for the betterment of their community and their tribal group. This is the true definition of an elder, not just an old black fella." Responses have been muted from Aboriginal people involved in the Games. Joy Murphy Wandin, senior elder of the Wurundjeri people, has been involved with the Games for 2 years, and her writings will be used in the opening ceremony. Though she was initially disappointed with the Black DST plan to protest on the territory without notifying the local elders, she said she had met with them and supported their right to voice their opinions. Five-time Paralympian Kevin Coombs, who chairs the Commonwealth Games Indigenous Working Group and Task Force, said Aborigines would be involved as athletes in the baton relay and the opening ceremony. "If you want to protest," he says, "this is a free country." So we're just going to take another quick musical break, and then we'll be right back with more Native Solidarity news.
Go to work and now go to work.
Welcome back to Native Solidarity News. The track we just heard was Sons of Member 2 with their song Kojua from the album that we've been listening to, The Soundtrack of a People. I'd like to thank the caller who called in. You two can share your constructive criticism with the show. I will try to cut down on the ums. And if other people have comments, suggestions with presentation or content or pronunciation of names, I also always appreciate help. The in-studio phone number here is 398-4616. You can write to Native Solidarity News at nsn@ckut.ca or call the Community News Department at 398-6788. That's 514-398-6788. The next piece of news comes from the News Miner about the effects of boarding schools on Indigenous peoples. There has, I guess, there's been another study. There are no clear conclusions to be drawn about the effect boarding schools had on Alaska Native children during the decades that the schools were in service. What is apparent, however, is that attending a boarding school was either a good or a bad experience for those who went through the educational system. The experience varied broadly. That looked like a decent article, but it apparently says nothing. It says that it was either a good or a bad experience, and apparently results are yet to be forthcoming. The next article comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, titled Indigenous Heartland Under Threat, about the theft of the Redfern community, which has for the long time been it's called the heartland of Aboriginal community, and they are trying to, the colonial powers that be are trying to take over this land and gentrify it. A problem that anybody living in big or small cities can appreciate. The state government's revitalization plan for Redfern and Waterloo is a long overdue initiative, according to the article. Decades of neglect have created complex social and economic needs. While this regeneration of the area is welcome by some, the government's single-minded focus on high-density commercial development as a solution is misguided. Under the draft bill, 444,000 square meters of commercial development will be created. Developments of up to 18 stories will be permitted, and parts of the block, the spiritual and actual home of the Indigenous community in Redfern, will be rezoned from residential to mixed use. Of the 8 precincts involved in the plan, 6 are rezoned as business zones of varying descriptions. The only rezoning to residential is for a hospital, which is formerly zoned as special use, and they will apparently be closing down this hospital in a very important Aboriginal community. It follows that the draft plan provides developers with significant incentives to concentrate on commercial rather than residential projects, meaning that people will no longer be able to live there. In effect, this plan will transform the heart of Redfern, the area surrounding the railway station, into another central business district. The draft plan environmental plan is but one of many that are to be implemented by the Redfern Waterloo Authority, but at this point the vision seems mundane. This is an opportunity for the government to create innovative and interesting urban renewal at the heart of the city, but it is also an opportunity for Redfern's cultural heritage to be celebrated and captured by such renewal. Redfern was the site of urban land rights when, in 1973, the reforming zeal of the administrator of the community brought about the Aboriginal Housing Company and affordable homes on the block. It is an area with significant architectural heritage, including the railway yards, tracks, and the warehouses of Northern Eveleigh, which date from the late 19th century and which are placed under threat by the draft plan. So this is, again, this is a problem that we can all appreciate, but it carries significant additional burden, when we see that it is, once again, as we've been discussing throughout this show in particular, but through all shows in general, displacement of Aboriginal peoples by these colonial powers who assume control and sovereignty over land over which they have no say and without even any form of a consultation.